Yes, this is A Conscious Time. That's the Instigators from their album Living Gift, Conscious Time. And this is Earth Matters, a regular monthly feature of the Ecology Hour. I'm your host, Ed Nieves, and my guest this evening is Raul Hernandez of Old Growth Again. Good evening, Raul.
Good evening, Ed.
Could you speak into the phone directly, my friend?
Yes, good evening, Ed. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah, that's better. Thanks. All right, so in keeping with that song, Conscious Time, the work that Raul does around forest restoration is definitely in keeping with what needs to happen in Conscious Time. Let's talk about the kind of work that you do, where you do it. Let's talk about your organization, Old Growth Again, and how about we just start with how long you've been doing this? How's that?
Well, you know, Ed, we started back in 95. We bought 40 acres in Annapolis, south-facing slope. You know, I was coming back from logging in the 60s, and we started thinning and built a cabin, which you helped build. And that's how we started. Now we manage about 700 acres, and we've got this furniture company that helps pay the bills. And ask me some more specific questions.
Well, let's talk about your original vision, which was to buy cut over forested lands and then bring them back. So what kind of properties were you buying or taking on?
The lands that we purchased back in the 90s were old Masonite lands. Masonite owned a lot of land. They owned the mills and stuff. They were a big industrial operation after the war. And then in the early 70s, they spun off these developments in Annapolis, about 2,000-acre developments of 40-acre pieces. That was zoned rural residential. And they, just before they sold them in the early 70s, they went back through and they took whatever they could legally. And back then, the only rule, because the forest practice rules didn't come into effect until, I think, 73, you had to keep one seed tree per acre. So you can imagine the condition of these lands. There's aerial photos from the early 70s when Masonite was mapping these lands, and it was pretty much clear-cut except for tan oak that they left and small trees, but it was about 80% of the canopy was gone. And so we're doing, you know, thinning and tree planting to lower the fire hazard and improve the species composition and increase the tree spacing, because these lands, when we inherited them, they had over 1,000 trees per acre. Instead of, you know, about 100, they were all small trees with limbs down to the ground, and you couldn't see a foot in front of you. And it was just a big, gigantic kindling pile ready for a little brush fire to just set it off into an inferno.
Can we talk about the species of trees that are found there? What do you have there?
Yeah, we're about 10 miles southeast of Gualala, and right behind the Sea Ranch in the northwest corner of Sonoma County. And the lands between the first and second ridges are a mix of Douglas fir and redwood, a little bit more redwood than Douglas fir. Depending, if you get closer to the ocean, then it's more redwood and less fir, and the further inland becomes more Doug fir and less redwood. We also have a little bit of sugar pine, which grows from about Stewart's Point up to Point Arena. And then it's hardwood. A lot of tan oak, a little bit of madrone, and a little bit of chinkapin and live oak, and even a little bit of California nutmeg. But most of the hardwoods is tan oak with a little bit of madrone.
Okay, so when you bought the first parcel and you started to walk the land and thought to myself, what am I getting into? You went looking for sources of information. I know that you and I went to a hardwood,
IFF,
yeah, you know, yeah. Exactly. Seminar up in Redway area, Whitethorn. But beyond that, where did you go looking for help?
I checked the literature, and there was one book in particular that really inspired me, and that was a book written by Gordon Robinson, The Forest and the Trees, A Guide to Excellent Forestry, which is was put out by Island Press in 1988. I must have read that book a dozen times. And there's a few other books that were good. Ray Raphael's books on tree talk and more tree talk were also excellent sources of basic on-the-ground information. But I joined the Institute for Sustainable Forestry, and you and I went up there probably in the late 90s and took a course on hardwood management. But I took a few other courses, too. And then I just picked the brains of the best foresters I can get my hands on. Fred Ufrat was active in forestry back then. He taught some of the courses at ISF, and he came out and gave me some advice on how to thin and how to plant. But basically, you know, we had to figure out a lot of it on our own, just by throwing out our backs and working, you know, nonstop on thinning the first 40 acres.
And then you had a conversation with Hans.
Oh, yes, but that was a little bit later.
Yeah, that's what I mean. It was a little later. After you'd made some of the mistakes and done some of the stuff and, you know, realized that, God, I'm doing this the hard way around or something, right?
Exactly. Well, we were trying to figure out, okay, how do you restore forest land without having to resort to government bailouts or being a nonprofit? Because we started as a nonprofit. We set up a nonprofit first, and I didn't really have the personality to have a begging bowl in hand every day. And we did get some grants from the state because they liked the thinning that we were doing, and there was some CFIP money in the early days, and before the Jackson Forest controversy pretty much shut down the CFIP funding. But in the 90s and even up to like 2001, Jill Butler from CDF was helpful in getting us some funding. But we were trying to figure out how to make forest lands pay for their own restoration. And I spent 5 years writing about it and figuring it out until we put together the manual that's on our website now, our forest restoration manual. And at the time, I was really proud of the result. I thought, you know, if we just figure out how much a forest grows every 10 years in additional lumber, and then we just cut half of the new growth, whatever it added, and we just did that every decade, we'd be fine. And I thought I had figured out some, you know, earth-shattering until I ran into Hans Burkhardt. I think it was through you, right?
Yeah, I think so.
So I went up to his place, beautiful place and lovely wife, and he was battling cancer at the time, but he was gracious enough to sit down and spend about probably 3 or 4 hours with me to convince me that my way was wrong and that his math, the book that he wrote, The Maximizing Forest Productivity, was the way to go. And I swallowed my ego and realized that he had done a lot more homework on the matter than I had. And we implemented his math. And the results speak for themselves. I mean, everyone who comes out to our lands and sees our thinning, you know, we inherited a timber harvest plant on a property in Little Creek that we purchased in 2002. It had a 50% timber harvest plant approved by CDF. We could have come in and taken 50% of the volume, which, of course, was, you know, everything. We would never do that, but we wound up cutting 8% of the stand. That was all we could muster. We couldn't even get it up to 10%, which is what Hans suggested. Hans' suggestion for ecoforestry or restoration forestry was that you cut a maximum of 10% of your standing timber volume in any one decade, and never to exceed that. And if you skip a decade, well, then tough. If you come back 2 decades later, you can't cut for 2 decades worth. You can't accrue the cut. It has to still be 10% in any one decade. So we cut 8% on the stand because, you know, the trees were just too small. You just couldn't do it. And it's like a poster child for restoration forestry. The land has a conservation easement with the Sonoma Land Trust, and they come out every year, and their volunteers are always changing. And, you know, it's impressive. It's worth seeing because we spent probably thousands of man hours thinning, well, not probably, we spent thousands of man hours thinning these lands of the overgrown hardwoods and spacing them out and then cutting the lower limbs and then cutting all the brush to boot height and scattering it, you know, lop and scatter, and then planting.
And what do you do with the hardwood, with the oak after you've cut it down?
Some of it is left for habitat, even though it's going to rot away, but we try to leave some of the bigger logs on the ground so that they'll decay, and 10 years from now we'll leave some more when we go back through. But most of it, we wind up anything between about 2.5 inches and about, I don't know, 18 inches or so, we usually take most of that out, roll it down the hill, and then cut it up for firewood. Roll it down the hill. We even improvised years ago, and we bought a couple of 18-inch culverts, plastic culverts, sliced them in half, and put them together. So we actually have four of them. I think they're 20-foot sections, so you have this 80-foot slide. I've even sent little kids down on it during the rains. And we just throw the firewood in the piles and then put it into the slide, and it slides all the way down to the lower road.
And
we cut about 200 or 300 cords a year from thinning, 20, 30 acres a year. And it helps pay for maybe a little bit over half of the thinning costs. It's a terrible business. You don't make any money with it.
Yeah, well, yeah, we'll get into that a little later. So, let's talk about what one of your timber harvest plans would look like relative to, well, I know that Fred's no longer doing this, and nowadays you guys use what's his name?
Randy Jacobson,
and I've seen some of Randy's plans, and they're not the worst, but they're not necessarily the best either. So what would be different about a plan that Jacobson would put together for Old Growth Again and Raul Hernandez as opposed to somebody else out there in the sticks?
Well, Randy does not have the best credentials in the environmental community. Okay, and I'll say that. I know that he's done some great conversions and stuff. Randy's a hardworking local guy. He lives in Redwood Valley. He's in his 50s. He grew up in another time, and yeah, he's concerned for the forest, but he looks at it a different way. He doesn't care about having ideal environmental credentials. He's just trying to raise his kids and get them through college and make a living. And I use Randy because he's really efficient. If you need something, if you need a firewood exemption to do some firewood cutting on a property, or you need him to do an NTMP, he's on it right away. And when I was trying to work with Fred, he was just too busy. He was running for Board of Supervisors. He was doing this, he was doing that. And I just couldn't get the service that I get with Randy.
Right. So go ahead. I'm sorry.
Well, I have to kind of twist Randy's arm a little bit and have him put in the limitations that we want and the restrictions that we want, because he's always telling me, "Well, you can cut a lot more. You can do this. You can do that." And I said, "Oh, I know we can do that, but that's not what we're about, Randy. We're about old growth again, about cutting at a rate that will bring back the old growth." Like Hans said, if you cut 10% per decade in perpetuity, and you never exceed that, and you never double up by skipping a decade, you wind up with a forest of trees of all ages, where the oldest trees are about 200 years old, which is the common definition of old growth. And if you then, on top of that, you set aside 5 trees per acre of all species, those trees will grow to be, ancient. They'll grow to be 500 or 1,000 years old. So that's what we do. We limit our timber harvest, our NTMPs, to a 10% cut in any decade, and then we set aside 5 trees per acre. And that's the main point. I mean, as long as you do that, as long as you don't vary that and you don't concentrate the cut like next to the streams, as long as you spread out your cut over your acreage, if you've got 20,000 board feet to the acre in the Wilpez, well, cut 2,000. If you've got 8,000 board feet on a hillside, well, you cut 800 board feet, and you just spread it out. And we've never had any problems with the government. And every time they come out, they're very supportive of the work we do. They wish more people would do it.
Great. So we've talked about what your motivation was to get in there, I think. Let's touch on that a little further. What made you decide that this was what you wanted to do? I mean, originally, I don't think that was it. I think it was, let's put a cabin up on this piece of property. What made you decide that you wanted to go a step further?
Well, in the early 90s, you and I were a lot younger, and we had a lot more energy, and we thought we could change the world. And, I was a member of every environmental organization and received every shrill newsletter and magazine you can get, you know, everything from, I won't mention any names because some of them weren't shrill, some of them were wonderful, but, you know, I was a member of every possible environmental organization, sent money to most of them, whatever I could scrounge up. But after a while, I realized that it was mostly talk. And what I thought we needed was an example, a hands-on example, a forestry operation that paid for itself and that restored the land for real. And that's what my motivation was. And it didn't, it, you know, from the time we started building the cabin and started thinning the first 40 acres to bringing out my buddies and showing them what we had done, people started giving me ideas. And one thing led to another, and people chipped in money to buy a mill and to pay for the nonprofit certification, because that was expensive, getting the original nonprofit. And just working in the woods, we started to realize that a lot could be done, that even though it would take a century or two centuries to bring back true old growth, in a decade, what could be accomplished was really eye-opening. I mean, the difference between our acreage and our neighbors is night and day. Even though our lands actually have a little bit less timber volume than theirs because we've come in and thinned them, nonetheless, what we've left is the very best. The spacing is much better. You create a lot of habitat because you open up the understory from below instead of having this massive limbs that you can't see through. Instead of having tons of poor quality trees that are suppressed and they're about to die, you take them out. You leave the very best ones. Not only the best ones, but mostly the best ones. You leave some of the wolf trees for the woodpeckers and for, you know, the osprey and whatever else is going to need broken top trees and stuff, because there's plenty of them. Because they left all that back when they logged. They left all the junky trees, what didn't have any economical value. They left all that. So instead of coming back in and taking the very best of what's left, you do the opposite. You come back in and you take the very worst of what's left. And you take a couple of decent trees, because otherwise you're going to starve, but you really, 98% of what you cut is stuff that's either suppressed, it's going to die, or it's just junk. And if you do that a couple of times in 20 years, you've got a gorgeous young stand that's nicely spaced, the fire hazard's reduced significantly, and it's such a pleasure to walk through. And I'm convinced, although I don't have any science to back it up, that the bird populations jump. You get a lot more birds flying through the forest than in a stand that's just limbs everywhere, and you can't even fly through it. It's all full of wood rats, and, you know, it's dramatic. It's hard to talk about it, but you really got to see it.
Yeah, I have. Now, I'm totally impressed. So let me ask about, what you said was basically there were two goals: one, to try and bring the forest back, and the other, to make money. And I guess the truth of the matter is that you've managed to do one but not the other, or you're working on one but the other one is not happening. I mean, the cost of doing this is expensive, isn't it?
Yeah, it's very expensive. I mean, that's why it's not done. You know, the only example of restoration, a successful long-term restoration, is the national park, the federal park that was in '78. They bought a bunch of cutover lands to augment the fragmented little islands of old growth that they purchased when LBJ was president. Carter did that, and then they funded. The caveat was that they were going to put in all the money necessary to close all the roads, fill them in, and completely restore the logged over land so that eventually you couldn't tell the difference between the logged lands and the old growth. But, you know, that was, considering the government did it, they spent 10 times more than they needed to. But it's gorgeous. It's beautiful. And it's worth seeing, because that's the best example that we have. But then what we're doing is we get the firewood to pay for half of it, but you got to figure, you're spending at least 100 hours on average to thin and pull out the firewood and lop and scatter and limb the branches on 1 acre the first time you go through. The first thinning is the most labor-intensive, because that's when you're completely changing the structure. You're taking out 50-60% of the limbs. In terms of volume, you're not taking out much volume, but you're taking out all this junk that's just kindling, and it's very labor-intensive. I mean, you could work all day in a 20 by 20 area and not be done. One guy with a chainsaw. So it takes a lot of time and a lot of cost. But what we did is we finally figured out that we've got to make a value-added product with a little bit of lumber that we actually do pull out of the forest. So So we developed this furniture business, and we had illusions of grandeur when we started. if we just make the most beautiful picnic tables in the world, that, you know, everyone will come knocking. And a lot of people have, and the business has grown from zero in whatever we started, like 2000, to, you know, we're probably doing about $1.6 million this year in furniture sales. But, you know, 700 acres and having a crew of guys up there, and we probably still lost $100,000, $150,000 this year, which in the past we used to cover by the inflating real estate prices. Everyone was willing to lend us money. But this year, you know, that illusion is gone. And the banks are all scared. They won't lend you any money. So, you know, we're in a real tight squeeze right now financially.
But you keep doing it.
You still got a
crew.
You know where I am right now? Yeah. You know where I am, Ed? We have 8 employees in Northern California.
Right.
But we moved the woodworking shop to Baja. We're 2 hours south of San Diego. I'm walking in the shop. It's a 10,000-square-foot shop. We have 25 employees here. And I'm walking around looking at the furniture. I mean, if you saw the stuff we make, it's just, you know, this thick timber stuff. We mill everything the old-fashioned way, a real 2x6, not a hardware store 1.5 by 5.25-inch 2x6. You know. And it's impressive, and people are willing to pay for it. It's just everyone's a little bit scared. This year our sales haven't grown like they've done in the past, pretty much flat with last year. But we know that if we could just batten down the hatches and survive, that our business will keep growing, and eventually the model will work, because our forest lands each year are getting healthier. They're producing better quality lumber. And we don't really have any competition in the stick timber end of things. And luckily, we still have some salvage old growth, which people are willing to pay a premium for.
And you use that for like a high-end, high-quality table or something?
Right. You know, you can, like, you want a nice picnic table, you can buy it out of, you know, you can go down to Yardbirds, it used to be Yardbirds, and they used to sell you a picnic table for like $400. And it was a nice table. It'll last you 8 or 10 years. Or you can buy a table from us, made 2 inches thick, all the hardware is stainless steel, and it has a 20-year warranty if you buy it in our second growth redwood. Or if you buy it out of our reclaimed wood, it's going to cost you a couple grand, but we're crazy enough to give you a 30-year warranty, because we know that stuff will outlast you and your kids, probably. You know how it is with the old growth. We pull the logs out of the woods from the 50s. They were cut in the 50s, and the wood's still perfect. The bark is gone, and the sapwood is gone, but the heartwood is as good as when the tree was alive.
And you guys mill that all up right on site, don't you?
Yeah, you know, we've been accused of being some kind of large industrial concern, but in fact, in 2000, my friend Warren Linney plucked down 10 grand so we can go up to Laytonville and pick up this Australian portable mill that was just hitting the market, the Lucas portable mill.
Right.
And that's the only mill we've ever had, this little Lucas portable mill with an 18-horsepower motor. We built the entire business with that machine, and the great thing about it was we can put it on the back of our John Deere Gator in parts and drive it anywhere into the woods. We didn't have to skid very far. Because, you know, we used to use horses exclusively to skid logs, Ike and Sparky, the Percherons. And, you know, finally we got a little bit smarter and we started using a tractor, too. But in the days that we were only using the horses, we didn't have any choice but to go into the woods and the small, old, little landings, wherever we can find them, and mill right there.
Right.
Because the horses couldn't skid anything uphill, and you didn't want them to skid 20 feet more than they had to, because they'd get tired.
Sure. So you still use horses occasionally?
Yeah. Stuart Schroeder out of Occidental, he's got a website and a company called Stonehorse Farms. He didn't come out this year because Ike and Sparky were getting old. They'd been working with us for 7 years, and they were graciously retired to the horse and carriage trade. And he brought in a couple of new Percherons, and they're not ready yet. So
right.
He's going to bring them out. He's going to bring them out in the spring next year. He's been training them on carriage rides and plowing the fields and that kind of stuff, and getting them. They're just a little bit too young. They've got a little too much hormones in them. He doesn't want to have an accident.
Kind of like you and I, when you get started 10 years, 15 years ago, whatever. Yeah, I know. Folks, this is KZYX 90.7 FM Philo, KZYZ 91.5 FM Willetton Ukiah, and of course 88.1 FM Fort Bragg. You're listening to Earth Matters, a regular monthly feature of the Ecology Hour. I'm your host, Ed Nieves, and my guest this evening is Raul Hernandez of Old Growth Again. And we're talking about forest restoration and the type of work that he and his partners do. Let's talk about restoration work versus sustainable harvesting or sustainable yield. Can we do that for a moment?
Sure, as long as we don't get any angry phone calls.
There's the first one. You want to take a call?
Let me first get them angry.
Okay, great.
Sustainable forestry is great. As you know, you and I were early adherents to the Institute for Sustainable Forestry's goals, which Fred Ufrat, by the way, wrote the first set of rules for Smartwood, and they were wonderful. And as Smartwood and the Forest Stewardship Council became international entities, huge, Washington based, legal and big money, blah blah blah, they diluted their standards, and it's not what the original vision from the early 90s was, not in practice. And for example, I've spoken several times with Mike Janai from Mendocino Redwoods, and I know that Mendocino Redwoods is doing a much better job than LP and GP ever did. But the basic math, and you don't have to take my word for it, have an MRC or whatever the new company's called, but look at their old lands before they took over Pacific Lumber. Look at their old lands and see what their timber volume is on their 200,000 acres that they first bought 10 years ago. And then look at their rate of cut for each year. And you'll find that it's a lot more than 10% per decade. It's probably 20 to 25%. And I'm not criticizing that, because compared to a standard industrial concern, that's wonderful. And when Hans was trying to get the Mendocino County Board of Supervisors to implement his plan for industrial companies, for LP and GP particularly, he was trying to limit their rate of cut to 2% per year or 20% per decade. And MRC is close to doing that. I'm not sure. I'm not an expert on their numbers, but I know that they're cutting way more than what would constitute restoration forestry. And when you cut at 20% per decade, you wind up with a forest of trees that are, on average, your rotation age is about 100 to 110 years, which, compared to what LP was doing, is still much better. But besides that, they're also they're still using some chemicals in the woods, and we don't need to talk about that. That's not necessary. It's just a cost-saving way of cutting back labor use and not to control the hardwoods. But, we do it the old-fashioned way. We cut them down. And we don't need to use chemicals. If you keep the canopy closed, by cutting only 10% per decade, the canopy is going to be a lot more closed up. And the hardwoods aren't going to grow back like crazy, like a wild bush, because they don't have the sunlight. Mm. And that's the key. That's why restoration forestry, which limits the rate of cut to 10%, your average rotation age of your trees is close to 200 years, not 100 or 110, which is what you get with a 20% cut per decade, like MRC, which is Smartwood certified and receives accolades from the governor, and probably on a big scale, they probably deserve it, but they could do better. They really could do.
Hey, Raul, we got a call. Let me take this call.
All right.
Hi, caller, you're on the air.
Hi, it's Deborah.
Hey, Deborah.
And for Raul, I'm another Ecology Hour host, and I'm definitely not an irate caller. I want to ask a question and then two questions. The first is, are you open to being communicated with from people? And if so, I'll take that answer off the air. But my next question is, I've been being a student of Paul Stamets in his advanced bioremediation programs and reforestation programs, and he is working on 120 acres on Cortez Island, and I'm wondering, you just seem like the ideal situation to be engaging the fungal realm to enhance things, and I wondered if you were working with that, and if you weren't, if you were interested. I'll take my answer off the air. Thanks, Ed.
Thanks, Deborah. So, first question, Raul, how do people get in touch with you?
Our website, the easiest way to find us is our furniture line is called Forever Redwood. So just type in foreverredwood.com or .org, and we'll come right up. You can send us an email right through the website, or my personal email address is Raul, R-A-U-L, at Sonic, S-O-N-I-C, .net. You know, I'm from Cuba, and in the 90s, when Bill Clinton was president, it was feasible for a Cuban native to travel to Cuba. Under Bush, it became impossible. But in the 90s, I went to Cuba a couple of times, and on one of the trips, I visited a greenhouse operation that was funded by the government. And it was pathetic of the amount of resources that the government gave them. But these guys were really, really intent on what they were doing. And they were about using fungus as a fertilizer. And they had developed all these different symbiotic relationships between fruit trees and different types of fungus that stimulated different aspects of the tree's development. And they were selling that to some Japanese concerns, and they were really excited about it, but they had no funding at all. I mean, they were operating like a $10,000 a year budget. But I don't know anything about what's going on in Cortez Island, but I'm sure, I mean, I do know that there's all kinds of interrelationships under the ground that are symbiotic with the roots of different trees and that all that's linked. So I'm sure that there's ways that we can inculcate the soil in these depleted lands with some mycorrhizal different types of strains that would enhance the growth rates of the lands and maybe the productivity of the soil. So I'm
cool.
Totally into that. It's what matters most is how the land is going to be.
Let's take another call, Raul. Hello, caller, you're on the air.
Hi, I'd just like to make a comment. You know, I was on the line during the lightning fires, and, you know, the big problems we had was usually standing dead stuff.
Sure.
Know? Carrying the fire up into the canopies and whatnot. And I've talked to some MRC foresters, and, you know, right behind my land there's a huge drainage that was hacked and squirted. A lot of tan oak in there from the 50s, you know. And I said, well, you know, guys, this is a big fire hazard, you know. Has anybody really thought about this? And they said, you know, since these fires, we're thinking about it really hard. So, you know, that approach may be changing, you know.
Well, that would be good.
You know, it's indicative of climate change. I mean, you know, having lightning fires in June is just not something typical for the coast, anyway. I'm on the coast. Right. And, yeah, you know, it's a huge problem if it's all dead and standing, you know.
Yeah, not only the fire hazard, my other concern with that is whether or not these chemicals that they're using will convert to PCBs under,
you know,
heat in terms of fire.
If you approach it from that way, they'll say, look, all the testing, all the stuff, we follow all the laws, this stuff is non-toxic. They use, I talked, Mike Janai came out, and, you know, he hacked and squirted right up to my property once.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, Mike, you know, this is a fire hazard. You know, this was going to burn down my barn. And he said,
right.
You're right. And he brought in some guys and Frank's firewood, and they cleared 3 acres close to my property line and hauled the stuff away.
So I should not buy any firewood from Frank's. Is that what you're...
Well, he said they use some chemical that causes the tree to overgrow. It grows itself out in some way. It's not that it's like a herbicide. It is some chemical that causes a tree to get confused, and it overgrows itself out and dies. So, you know, I don't know what the chemical is.
It's arsenal, is what they use.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you know, they'll just claim that stuff is, you know, biodegradable, yada, yada, yada. But standing fire danger is something they really care about.
Sure.
Know, because it affects their timber values as well.
Right.
So anyway, that was just my comment.
Great. Thank you, a caller.
Yeah.
Raul, I got another call. Hang on, man. Hi, caller. You're on the air. Hello. Oh, must have lost him.
Hello.
Hello, yes.
Yeah, hi, Ed. Howie Seidel,
hey,
from Albion.
Good.
Hey, good show. I want to give Raoul credit, you know, with this vision that he had and manifested for, even with all the labor, for restoring forests to old growth. As you know, those of us now elders, but in the forest defense movement, we were putting our finger in the dike. I mean, we slowed them down with LP, and we got them to get out of here.
Right.
But we weren't restoring forests. And, of course, the vision always was to buy vast tracts of land and, you know, through government or otherwise, which is a blessing when that can happen, like at the big river watershed.
Sure.
But so what he's doing is a model, Raoul, what you're doing is a model, I think, for hands-on direct ability to, you know, make a change. And it's a beginning because many of us were so disappointed, you know, with what was going to come. We were just holding the line. You know, we were active. We were being arrested. We've been in there. But what you're doing is a vision that that only blessings and goodness. I'd like to also say with MRC, no matter what they say on the poisons, they use poison. And not only that, but as far as their 10% cut, it's you just look at the land. I've walked all over this county in the forest, and it's pretty decimated no matter what they claim how good they're doing it. They're not LP, but they're pretty close. I mean, they're bottom feeders, MRC. They go in and they buy up like they've done now up north with Pacific Lumber, and they're going to extract the profit out of it. We fought with them for years. And ultimately, they didn't stay out of the watersheds down by the streams. And, you know, so we, you know, there's some, you know, definite realities around when people are out there for profit. And they're hungry for that. So without, you know, pointing fingers at a specific people or something, but just recognizing that, Raoul, your vision of, you know, of hands-on and doing it, and collectively keeping the vision of restoring and healing these lands, that's the way to go, and be conscious of what's happening around us. So just want to give thanks for that.
Thank you, my friend.
Okay, Ed. All right, bye-bye.
Raoul, I'm sorry, man, we got another call. Hi, caller, you're on the air.
My question is about benign neglect. I mean, I like this idea of people being able to go in and restore the forest, but I think our knowledge is so limited of what's really going on. My idea is that the forest can restore itself if we just leave it alone. So I'd like a little response on that.
Sure.
And I'll get off the phone.
All right. Thank you, caller. So, Raoul, can we just leave it alone?
You know, there's a park in up the Mendocino Coast. I think it's called Van Dam.
Yeah.
If you want to see what leaving it alone will do, it was logged in the turn, I don't know, I think in the 20s, and it's right close to the ocean, so it's a high, it's like a site too. It's really nice redwood land, but what you got in this particular case, and it's probably as good as it's going to get because of the high of quality of the soils and the land, is instead of having trees that are going to be, you know, 10 foot in diameter or more, you've got five of them that are 2 foot in diameter, or 2.5, growing together in some cases. They're just as tall as the old trees. They're huge trees, but you're not going to get any big trees, not very many, because they don't have any room. So that's, in that case, so that's about as good as you're going to get if you leave it alone. Now, in our lands that have a lot of hardwoods, see, the Van Dam lands have very little hardwoods. When they came in, they took 95% of the redwood volume. They took maybe 80-85% of the Doug fir volume. They took whatever they did on the sugar pine. But they left half or more of the tan oak because they didn't care about it. It didn't have any value. They'd knock it down if it was in the way, but otherwise they'd left it. So you've got the species composition has been transformed, where you used to have maybe 20% hardwoods, 15% hardwoods by volume on these average quality lands. Now they're 50% tan oak by volume. And most of the stems are hardwoods. So if you don't do anything besides a big fire hazard, which will probably burn those lands a couple of times, you're never going to get the spacing or the species composition ever that it used to be. It just won't happen. Because we were the ones that caused this unnatural event, this cataclysm basically, to occur. And so we have to go in and fix it if you want it to get back to anything like it was as far as species composition and spacing. And also to rebuild the soil. You know, you can come out to our lands and you can see what letting nature do it by itself looks like now 45 years after versus our lands. I think if you went in and you did one or two thinnings like we're doing and then you never did anything, then it would be fine. But I really think we got to go in at least twice and try to rebalance the worst aspects of the severe logging that was done.
So that touches on two things that I want to discuss further. One of them is tree planting, especially to bring back composition of the soil, of the species, you know, increase the species composition. And then the other one is the ability of the small landowner to do this on his or her property. So let's start with planting trees. And how many trees do you think you've planted over the years?
You know, not a lot of trees. We probably planted maybe 15,000 trees in the last 8 or 9 years. But when we started, we were planting small trees, 200 to the acre, because that's what Fred Ufrat told us to do, and that's what the Davis, the California Department of Forestry Nursery in Davis told us to do. But they were tiny little plugs, and we planted them with a lot of enthusiasm. I think you came up there with your daughters.
Yeah, I was there.
One or two early years. And, you know, we came back a year later, and 95% of them were dead or close to dead. So it didn't work. We did it a couple of years, and we had the same results. We still have a few of these trees alive out of the first, I don't know, 6,000 or 8,000 that we planted in the, you know, 8 or 10 years ago. And so we figured out after like 3 years of this, it doesn't work. So we started growing the trees. We get 2,000 trees from Davis, and we plant them in 3 to 5 gallon buckets, transplant them, and then baby them in under a redwood grove where they got a little bit of sun, and just water them and baby them until the fall. And then in December when it started raining, we take all the trees that were at least 20 inches tall and had a nice root ball. And we knew if they had a nice root ball because the roots had come out the bottom of the pot and the pots were sticking to the ground. So if they weren't sticking to the ground, we wouldn't use them.
And, the scientific method.
And then scientific method. Then we started planting those trees deep in the ground. I won't take too much time, but basically by planting them under the ground, at least where the top of the root ball was 4 to 6 inches under the contour of the land, then you added a few inches of duff for to keep the moisture in, and only plant when the ground was saturated. And then by planting them under the contour, water would collect during the rainy season. And presto, we went from 5% survival rate to 90-95% survival rate, and all the trees grew 6 inches, 8 inches, 10 inches the first year, and every year since. So now we've got, well, we used to plant 200 to the acre. Now we only plant 30 to 40 to the acre. Mostly redwood. On the really harsh sites, we plant sugar pine because the redwood just won't grow. But the National Geographic magazine came out in the spring. They were doing a transect. They're going to publish a couple articles in next year's magazine about the redwood forest. It's the first time they've studied the redwoods in 64. Michael Fay, who's famous, actually, in the National Geographic circles for doing all kinds of stuff in Africa for the last 30 years. He and one young lady, photographer and researcher, Lindsay Holmes, walked from just north of the Hearst Castle, starting, about a year ago, all the way up to the groves in Oregon, talking to everybody, photographing everything, covering everything from satellites, and they spent a couple of days with me. They were most impressed with the thinning that we were doing and the tree planting. But Michael said that nobody was doing tree planting like that, and he wanted to come back and study the results this winter and do some more tree planting with us.
Cool. All right, caller, whoever you were, call us back, and we will, I promise, pick up the phone line and put you on the air and let you ask your question. Raul, let's talk about the small landowner being able to do this on his or her property. Hang on a second, brother. Hi, caller, you're on the air.
Hi, Ed. Thanks for the show.
You're welcome.
My question is, I'd love to hear more about when you talk about leaving the canopy closed, talking about understory and microclimates, the things that really don't show up on the spreadsheets when areas are cleared off and then never really come back if it's just, you know, agriculturally farmed. The understory, the microclimates, you know, things that are a little more ephemeral.
Great. Let's talk. Go ahead, Raul.
No, it's a great question. I mean, I know exactly what he's talking about. I mean, you can talk about numbers all day long, but really, what you're trying to recreate is the closed canopy and the open understory, which is typical of old growth forests that had a regular fire regimen. Now, we can't burn because the redwoods have become too populated, so we have to imitate the effects of a fire. But there's a couple of things. When we thin, we're working to create a multi-level canopy again, or several canopies. The hardwoods tend to make a lower canopy, as do the young trees. And then, of course, the conifers make a higher level canopy. But when you're thinning, the main thing is to thin from below. And that's what Hans and I used to talk about when we were laying this stuff out. Thinning from below is when you're going into these stands that have 1,000 limbs to the acre, 1,000 stems to the acre. Most of them are already suppressed with trees above them that have already closed the canopy, even though the canopy tends to be low because the trees are young. So as you're taking out a lot of these stems, you're not opening up the canopy. And we made some mistakes in the early years because we were told that we had to open up the canopy more in order for the trees to grow. Well, we learned that was completely wrong, and this is what you said, because you need to maintain the microclimate, you need to maintain the moisture, you need to limit the wind movement in the woods. And you do that by wherever you've got a major road, don't limb your lower limbs. Keep the limbs all the way to the ground. You want to create a natural barrier. But the main thing of all this, if there's one thing that I've not talked about, and that is soil building. Lopping and scattering. If you own your own land and you want to try to build up the productivity of your soil, unless you're a scientist and you can get into mycorrhizal stuff and putting that into your soil, short of that, the best thing you could do is, as you're limbing the lower branches, to try to open up your forest so you can walk through it and you can see. Cut that stuff up. Scatter it. Cover any bare spot you have in your soil. Cover it. If there's not ferns growing on it, or if there isn't a bunch of leaves from your tan oak, if it's bare soil, cover it. Cover it with limbs. The limbs will decompose and will create structure into the soil, and the small branches and the leaves will add much-needed nutrients into the soil. And so that's the one thing that we do. When you go in and you see a couple acres that we just thinned, it looks like a green carpet because it's all covered in green leaves up for about 6 inches to a foot high.
I remember talking about microclimates. I remember when we first went out there, when you first got started, and me standing under a bunch of oak trees and saying, "Hey, Raul, you got to leave these right here." And you were like, "Why, man?" I said, "Because there are black mushrooms right here." And it's that type of thing that you know, you get to see while you're there on the ground, you know, and you can make those kinds of decisions. Leave this, take that, thin here, you know. Fire hazard coming up the hill, let's reduce it. And still at the same time, or hand in hand with that, it gives you an opportunity to leave those little pockets and microclimates there. And I remember watching, you know, from the first year to the second to the fourth to the fifth to the seventh, the conversion, you know, from, yeah, let's open up this canopy because that's what we're being told by foresters to, no, you know, Ed, those guys don't know what they're talking about.
Oh, yeah, no. Now you want to keep the canopy as closed as possible and just create a little bit of growing room for some of your trees. But basically the canopy should be, you know, depending on how you measure it, 85-90% closed. I think all the time. I think the soil erosion is your biggest danger long term.
We got another call.
Go ahead.
Hi, caller, you're on the air.
Hi. I'd like to know again how many acres he's talking about, and the second thing I'd like to know is about the animal population. What is there now, and what is he hoping for in his vision in the future? And I'll take my answer off the air.
Thank you, caller.
Thank you.
Sorry, go ahead, Raul.
We own about 550-560 acres in Annapolis and in several areas. They're not all contiguous lands. We've got a couple hundred acres here, 40-acre parcels that are together, and then another couple hundred acres a couple miles away. Basically, we've been buying it as we can, you know, and with the real estate run-up in the last few years, we haven't been able to buy anything. And then we own another 125 acres just south of, one of the tributaries to the Navarro in Philo at the end of Nash Mill Road. That land, unfortunately, we haven't been able to do anything other than pay the mortgage payments on it because it's just a little too far away. Actually, we went up there and thinned a couple acres. As far as population...
I'm sorry, I was going to say that's way up at the top of Nash Mill Road.
Right.
So, go ahead.
As far as the animal populations and the wildlife, it's pretty much what everybody knows is in the redwoods. I mean, we're not trying to do anything as far as introducing anything or changing anything. The thing that I've noticed is that the migratory birds seem to hang out longer. Maybe I just never noticed them because I was too busy, but we have a lot of migratory birds flying through our forests, and the bird population seems to be higher. I think that opening up the forest makes it easier for them to hunt some of the bigger birds, and it just makes it more, there's more areas for them to be protected. I mean, they're flying under a canopy instead of flying over it because they couldn't really fly through that dense, overgrown stuff that we had before.
Great. Now you were talking about soil erosion. Let's finish that thought.
That's the biggest problem. I mean, if you study the history of forest land use in the world over the last 8,000 years, you know, the biggest calamity is, for example, in the Senate in Greece, they talked for hundreds of years about protecting their forests, and Plato said that what was left of the soils of Greece was like, you know, the skeleton of an emaciated elder or something. You know, it was destroyed. The biggest threat the ancient Greeks had between walking between Sparta and Athens was being eaten by lions. And anybody that goes to Greece now knows that that's completely impossible because there's no forest lands left. All the soils were washed away because they cut the forest down, and then they do really poor subsistence agriculture for a couple decades, and all the topsoil would wind up in the rivers, and that was the end of that. And that's what humanity's pretty much done widespread. The biggest problems that they have in China is the same thing, soil erosion and the desertification. And in northern Africa, you know, the cedars of Lebanon are mostly gone now, and all that's desert. 85% of Israel was forest land in biblical times, just prior to biblical times. And now it's about 15% forest land, and that's after the Jewish state has recreated a lot of forests. It was even less than that 50 years ago. And in the U.S., we're fortunate because two-thirds of the country was worn out broken forest just 300 years ago. But about a third of that forest land is gone now. And even what remains, the percentage of that is old big trees, is just minute, and maybe 5% of the remaining acreage. And if you don't take care of the soil, you can't grow the big trees again. And in California, we're lucky because the redwoods have only been logged really hard since World War II. And so the soil, in most cases, is still relatively intact. Even after some of the abuses that Pacific Lumber did, most of their lands, the soil is, I wouldn't say it's intact, but it's relatively intact. I mean, in Germany, they try to grow big oaks and big trees like they did in medieval days, and they can't do it. The soil just won't sustain it. The trees just won't grow as big. So, but there's things you could do to build up the soil, like we mentioned a few minutes ago. And as long as you take care of the soil by keeping it covered, you just don't want to have exposed soil because it's an invisible destructive force.
Cool. Well, thank you, man. I appreciate you taking the time to come on the air with us and talk about your vision and the work that you've been doing since 95. And folks, my guest is Raul Hernandez. You can reach him at raul@sonic.net or through his furniture business's website, Forever Forest. Is that right, Raul? I think that's right.
Either Forever Redwood or
Forever
Old Growth
Redwood.
Again.
Forever Redwoods, yes. Or, of course, Old Growth Again. I'm going to extend this invitation, man. I know you didn't do this, but I think if folks wanted to come and take a look, then they should give you a call, and maybe you can set up a time for folks to come out, and I'd come with them and, you know, walk the lands again and maybe pick up some loppers and do some of that kind of work.
Absolutely. I'm going to be back up. I'll be back up in Annapolis around the 10th of November, and I'm up there every couple of weeks for a few days. So anybody that's really interested, or if they want to come up and plant some trees, and we'll be planting trees right in the beginning of January, at the peak of the wet season. There's a 60-page forest restoration manual on the website. If anybody's interested in getting into the nuts and bolts of how to restore their own lands, of course it applies to redwood lands anywhere in California, but it can be used anywhere. The basic principles as laid out by Hans, and then the hands-on insights that I gained for many years, and my business partners that helped me do write the paper and sweat and throw off their backs. It's all there, and it's probably been read by 50 people. But
I'm one of them.
Just type in forest restoration on the search bar on our website, and it'll come right up.
And that's a free download, isn't it?
Yeah. It's a PDF.
Right.
It's not that big. It takes about 10 seconds to download it.
All right. Well, thank you, man. I got a couple of announcements to make before I go off the air and Marcia comes in to do ensemble. Always a pleasure to talk to you, brother, and I really, really thank you for taking the time to do this and taking time away from your family. Appreciate it, man.
My pleasure. Keep up the good work, and I hope I can see you real soon.
All right, brother. Thanks. Take care.
Adios.